CROM Vault Podcast, episode number 320. Monday, December 17th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hello, CROM Vault listeners. The month of December is half gone, and this is the first time I'm getting a Vault episode to you. Sorry about that. So what you have here is yesterday's CROM radio show, which normally I would put out on the regular CROM feed, you know, the free one, the big room. But because, you know, folks in the CROM Vault are hungry, here's some steak. Or, you know, for you vegetarians, whatever is really delectable to vegetarians. I used to be one, so you'd think I could come up with something, but not so much. The guest is Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator and voracious book reader. So we'll be talking about regular CROM topics as well as animation, which is something I generally don't talk about on the show, you know, when Dermot's not around. But before we get started, I want to play for you about a 4 or 5 minute clip from Cosmos, not the original series with Carl Sagan, but the newly rebooted series. It's not so new now, it's a few years old now, but, you know, the 21st century version with, what's his name, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson basically tells a story that is so manipulative in its presentation of the facts as to be false, about Giordano Bruno. So here's the clip from Cosmos, and then it will become clear why I played it once we get into the conversation with Dermot.
His name was Giordano Bruno, and he was a natural-born rebel. He longed to bust out of that cramped little universe. Even as a young Dominican monk in Naples, he was a misfit. This was a time when there was no freedom of thought in Italy. But Bruno hungered to know everything about God's creation. He dared to read the books banned by the church, and that was his undoing. In one of them, an ancient Roman, a man dead for more than 1,500 years, whispered to him of a universe far greater, one as boundless as his idea of God. Lucretius asked the reader to imagine standing at the edge of the universe and shooting an arrow outward. If the arrow keeps going, then clearly the universe extends beyond what you thought was the edge. But if the arrow doesn't keep going, say it hits a wall, then that wall must lie beyond what you thought was the edge of the universe. Now if you stand on that wall and shoot another arrow, there are only the same two possible outcomes. It either flies forever out into space, or it hits some boundary where you can stand and shoot yet another arrow. Either way, the universe is unbounded. Cosmos must be infinite. This made perfect sense to Bruno. The God he worshipped was infinite. So how, he reasoned, could creation be anything less? It was the last steady job he ever had. And then, when he was 30, he had the vision that sealed his fate. In this dream, he awakened to a world enclosed inside a confining bowl of stars. This was the cosmos of Bruno's time. Experienced a sickening moment of fear, as if the bottom of everything was falling away beneath his feet. But he summoned up his courage.
spread confident wings to space and soared toward the infinite, leaving far behind me what others strained to see from a distance. Here, there was no up, no down, no edge, no center. I saw that the sun was just another star, and the stars were other suns, each escorted by other Earths like our own. The revelation of this immensity was like falling in love.
Bruno became an evangelist, spreading the gospel of infinity throughout Europe. He assumed that other lovers of God would naturally embrace this grander and more glorious view of creation.
What a fool I was.
He was excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church in his homeland, expelled by the Calvinists in Switzerland, and by the Lutherans in Germany. Bruno jumped at an invitation to lecture at Oxford in England. At last, he thought, a chance to share his vision with an audience of his peers.
I have come to present a new vision of the cosmos. Copernicus was right to argue that our world is not the center of the universe. The Earth goes around the sun. It's a planet just like the others. But Copernicus was only the dawn. I bring you the sunrise.
Outrageous!
The stars are other fiery suns, made of the same substance as the Earth. And they have their own watery Earths, with plants and animals no less noble than our own.
Are you mad or merely ignorant? Everyone knows there is only one world.
What everyone knows is wrong. Our infinite God has created a boundless universe with an infinite number of worlds.
Do they not read Aristotle, where you come from? Or even the Bible?
I beg you, reject antiquity, tradition, faith, and authority. Let us begin anew by doubting everything we assume has been proven.
Heretic! Infidel!
Your God is too small!
Join Black Sheep Radio and help build the community we all want to live in. You can become a member online right now at wool.fm or leave us a message at 802-460-9665. Be the change you want to see. This is WOOL-FM 91.5 Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls. This is KMO. You are listening to Sea Realm Radio. And if all has gone according to plan, I am joined by Dermot O'Connor, the Angry Animator. Dermot, are you there?
I'm here.
Excellent. All right. Now that I've got you here, I am going to push you to the side for a moment while I take care of a little bit of housekeeping. Bulletin board. All righty. Housekeeping complete. All tabs on my browser closed except for one. It is www.angryanimator.com. So I have the Angry Animator on the line here. Dermot, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
What are you doing?
Right now, I'm working on, maybe you saw one of my more recent posts, which is an article called The 21 Foundations of Animation, which is requiring a little bit of nerve because it's basically rewriting some of the old Disney material. They had their 12 principles of animation, so I'm expanding it to 21. And so I'm afraid people will say, who the heck does this guy think he is to be, correcting the Disney geniuses. But essentially what happened was that the two old Disney experts, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, who were, far better talented artists than I was, at the very end of their careers, they wrote this book called The Illusion of Life, and they wrote about the 12 principles of animation. And I've been doing my Lynda courses, and I've just been realizing very slowly that, these 12 principles just don't work. And it's not that they're wrong, it's that they're not enough. So I've added to them and just rearranged them slightly. And I think the old guys would have liked it. And I think they probably would have gone, oh, yeah. But if you go onto YouTube, you see all these, amateur videos where people have animated the 12 principles and they think they've done their job. And you haven't. You're not even halfway. You're slightly over halfway there. But it leaves out a lot of stuff that's, really fundamental that you can't, do without. And it took me years of trial and error and hacking to realize that. So anyway, that was a huge essay, and I'm doing a video. I'm almost finished with the video, which will go up. It'll be 9 minutes long, and that's going to go up on my YouTube channel, and that'll be the kind of linchpin. And then I will use this as a tree to hang all of my future courses and lessons off. So I'll be able to categorize all my own movies.
So 9 minutes for 21 foundations of animation?
Yeah, it's a pretty fast run through. But the thing is, I mean, if, you know, that each foundation is fairly concise. I mean, you can explain each one very quickly. Mastering each one will take you years, you know, and then integrating all of those things into one scene. That's huge. So if you look at the latest post on Angry Animator, it's a my reel, and there's a wizard scene that I animated. I animated that entire scene in Photoshop, and you know, using totally traditional techniques, timing charts, in-betweening by hand. And the point of that was to prove there's no like digital magic going on here. This is as good, as close as you're going to get to drawing on paper, and you really have to use all the traditional good habits. It really breaks you, actually. Working in Photoshop totally breaks you from bad habits, because it's so difficult to do animation in Photoshop that you're really falling back on classic hand-drawn pencil and paper mental habits that, you know, we tend to atrophy a little bit. And that's my kind of scene that look. I wanted it to look like it was done in the 60s or 70s, because that was kind of the high watermark, I think, of like, you know, the Disney and Don Bluth styles. And I used to work for Don Bluth. I was trained by him. So, you know, that's kind of the background that I have.
For people who don't recognize the name, who is Don Bluth?
Don Bluth, he was the animator probably best known for Space Ace and Dragon's Lair, the computer games. But he also did Secret of Nim, Land Before Time, American Tail. And then the movies become wobbly after that. So All Dogs Go to Heaven. Like more recent ones would be Thumbelina, Pebble and the Penguin. You know, when I meet people now in their 30s, they go, "Oh my God, you worked on that!" Because a lot of them grew up in the age of VHS, so they have fond childhood memories of watching these movies that when they came out nobody saw. You know, and for years afterwards, I would tell people who I worked for, and they'd blank. But now it's very strange. Now I have like a generation of people who are impressed by the fact that I did these things. You know, these generational changes are amazing.
You know, you mentioned the book, The Illusion of Life. I used to have that book, but then before I moved out of the country, there was a massive book sale, and I divested myself of a great many books, most of my books, in fact. And yeah. Unfortunately, that was one of them. Also, unfortunately, it was one of those books that I would, you know, take off the shelf and reverently page through from time to time, but never actually read cover to cover.
Mm. Yeah, it's like a real tome, but it's very disordered. And for a long time, it was the only one of the very few animation textbooks we had. We had, when I worked for Don Bluth in Dublin, we had a bunch of them shipped over from America at great cost. And, you know, you learned quite a bit from it. But again, it was scattered. You know, the guys didn't write it as clearly when they were writing it, they were putting it all together. But honestly, I wish I could have a time machine and go back and help edit it, you know, to make it more useful as a practical guide as well. And less of a, you know, here's this and then here's that. And there's a more recent book by Richard Williams, who animated Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And he must have spent the best part of a decade on his book. I mean, he has just gone to town on his book. It's called The Animator Survival Kit. And the second edition is even a bit longer. And it's a lot of walk cycles and run cycles. But it's astonishing. When you flip through that, your jaw will hit the floor. And even if a person isn't into animation, it's still fascinating to see just, you know, the kind of mechanics go behind a lot of it.
I have been watching a big change of subject here, but you live in Portland, Oregon, and if you go to YouTube and you want to get irritated about those, you know, those ill-behaved youngsters in black, if you search for Antifa, some of their worst behavior of recent days has taken place in Portland, Oregon. Have you borne witness to that at all?
Not directly, no. I tried to stay well clear of them because I think there's just nothing but trouble.
Have you seen any of the videos, though, of them, like, blocking traffic or, you know, yelling at police or chasing people down?
Yeah, I've heard about them, and I've heard the action described, and it sounds fairly reprehensible. But, yeah, like I said, I go downtown maybe six times a year or something like that. So my scope for encountering them would be pretty limited. But yeah, if I ever am downtown and that happens, I'm staying well clear of it. My girlfriend was shot by the cops. I think I mentioned this last time we talked, when she was trying to film one of these encounters between Antifa and the white pride nationalist types, who were being particularly obnoxious. So you've got two groups of people that are both kind of off their rockers. and they're just, and the cops as well, just shooting like grenades into the crowd willy-nilly, is, you know, so there's nothing good can come out of that. I don't see how anything good can come out of it. So yeah, I would be afraid of anybody being caught up in it.
Well, it's my understanding that the Portland mayor has instructed the police to stand down, at least, you know, when Antifa are not in active conflict with the white nationalists, but when they're just out, you know, in making a show of force, basically, and giving orders to just normal civilians, the police stand back and let that happen.
Right. Yeah, it's, I have a very low opinion of politics in general in this country, and that's across the spectrum. I'm watching the Yellow Jackets in France with great interest to see, you know, if that'll have any effect. And that's a weird movement. It seems to be all over the place and could go any direction. And again, has a very violent, destructive component. But, you know, the French seem to know how to do riots. They're seems to be in the blood.
I think the French like to remind their betters that, you know, they still know how to make guillotines.
Yes, yeah, and pick up flagstones and break things with them, yeah. It's a very, very strange movement. And I can see that, but we're reading a lot about that, and that seems to be a movement that has a strong left progressive component, but there's also extreme right-wing components and extreme left-wing components in there as well. And they're all just right now, like, mingling around. Whereas I think Antifa seems to be more of, I don't know, my understanding of Antifa are more like middle-class trust fund types, you know, who are play-acting at being trots. And usually they get clobbered pretty badly when they do get into fisticuffs with the real toughs. So, I don't know, it strikes me as a bit of street theater more than anything right now, which again can change. I mean, these things can suddenly take off and become not theater, and not strictly symbolic, but my I guess I'm politically quietest for the most part these days. I just try to not get my head cracked. You know, I've got I don't like to get involved with the American healthcare system. So, you know, and also, you know, I still keep my Irish passport up to date. So, ready to run back at the drop of a hat.
When you say you think it's street theater, are you talking about Antifa or the Yellow Vests?
Both. I think not so much the Yellow Vests, but the Antifa and the white nationalist types here are doing a lot of street theater. And I think if they were serious, they'd be doing grassroots organizing. I'll be afraid of the fascists when they start opening soup kitchens, you know, and when they start, you know, trying to help poor people and stuff like that, like the stuff that the actual fascists used to do in addition with their street theater. And I think the most dangerous thing, too, you can give a fascist is a martyr. And so far, luckily, that hasn't happened. The martyrs have been on the other side. There's a whole blood sacrifice element in this, too. Like, you know, the whole thing with the original, like, Nazis in Germany was the blood sacrifice and the blood flag, which was the original swastika that got, you know, drenched with the blood of some of the original Nazis who were shot, I think, in Nuremberg or Munich or wherever the first parade was by the Weimar police. And this flag became the sacred totem to the Nazis. And, you know, every future swastika had to physically touch it for the magical charge to pass to it, blah, blah, blah. So I think the last thing you want to do with a fascist is provide them with some corpses that they can turn into fetishes. But, you know, there's the whole argument, the counter argument to that as well. If the left had stood up and fought the original Nazis, you know, they wouldn't have risen. But the thing is, they did. And they fought a heck of a lot harder than Antifa is fighting. I think, honestly, these people are just pathetic. And you're giving them oxygen by treating them as if they're an existential threat. They're clowns. They had an attempt to have a big, hard right-wing anti-immigrant parade in London, and it had, like, just a miserable turnout. So the last thing you want to do is to turn out with, like, you know, to make it seem like these people are a danger to you. They're to be ridiculed. They're to be mocked. But I think too many people on what passes with the left these days have a problem with the concept of comedy, humor, satire, because they're so afraid of causing offense. They're even apparently afraid of offending Nazis. And, you know, I think the Mel Brooks approach would probably be a lot more productive. You know, make the other people look like clowns, because they are. You know, but I think there's a lot of cathartic rubbish going on at the moment.
Well, why do you think folks are feeling such an itch to engage in cathartic rubbish?
I think they've lost their grip, you know, on reality, and I think they've been losing it for a while. Like, I think people who think that, you know, Donald Trump is Hitler. You know, I'm not saying, and then you say stuff like this and you go, you're a Trumper. I'm not a Trumper. I don't like Trump. But He's not Hitler. And I think we spoke about this before in the immediate aftermath. I saw my Facebook reminds and posting Kristallnacht memes. And I'm thinking, this is, as bad as this guy is, he's not Hitler. And no, he's not even Mussolini. He's a, you know, isolationist nation, America first, or like he's a Birch type. You know, he's not Adolf Hitler. And you know, Mike Pence isn't going to institute the Handmaid's Tale as constitutional policy. You know, these guys aren't good guys, but they're not this like existential horror that people think. And neither was Obama the saint that a lot of these people seem to have thought, or Clinton was the saint that either the Clintons were the saints any of these people thought. And I think you had to have been sleepwalking for many, many years in a kind of this partisan fog to lose track of reality. I'm sorry about screaming cats. acoustic metaphor for the country, maybe. You know, I read politics fairly well, and for a very long time now, and you know, you see a lot of things come and go, and you know, I think people just weren't paying attention to a lot of environmental or energy stories, a lot of material, all the wars, the anti-war movement vaporized when Obama got in. That's been proven statistically. There was studies on that that show that something like 75% of the anti-war movement disappeared the moment Obama was elected. Which tells you that the anti-war movement was largely an anti-Bush movement. And, you know, if that's the extent of a person's political nous, then they're going to start reaching for very strange conclusions when a particularly nasty opposition politician gets into the White House. And it's a lack of perspective and this weird thing people have to want to see the world in Manichaean terms, you know, like one side's all good and one side's all evil or whatever. And it's just gotten worse. And I saw it on election night. I thought, oh God, this is just going to get really bad in the next 4 years. Actually, I still think Trump's going to get reelected in spite of all this stuff. And if that happens, then the insanity is only just beginning. Then we're only in year two of an 8-year, you know, cycle. And and then the other crowd will get somebody in who will drive the other half of the country mad for another 4 or 8 years. Oh God! Yeah. Anyway, I hope that kind of explains my general position on it.
Well, pardon me. It does, and I was pretty familiar with your position before, because you know this is not our first conversation. But I ask because really, you know, in all honesty, I ask because I wrote to you and I said, "What are you reading?" And you told me. You know, titles of books that I was not familiar with, and I couldn't begin to ask you, you know, informed questions on that topic. But just, you know, for honesty's sake, what topic am I avoiding here?
Oh, my historical research into the medieval and Renaissance translation, I guess, or transmission as well of ancient Greek knowledge, which came to the West through the Muslim world, specifically the Abbasid caliphs in Iraq. And the West, the writer of that book, Dimitri Goutas, he wrote that the Islamic translation movement in Baghdad should be as well known to the world as the Italian Renaissance or, you know, the ancient Greece. It's that important. And it's gone down the memory hole. It's been almost collectively flushed. If people have an idea of it, it's very vague. This is a period that lasted for the best part of 250 years. The caliphs and the elites of Baghdad were paying translators, many of them Greek, from Byzantium and from various backgrounds, to translate any kind of classical Greek books that were important to them, which turns out to be almost all of them, all of the works on natural philosophy. And they would pay up to, in modern money, something like $24,000 a month to a translator. So if you were a translator, if you could speak Arabic and Greek, you were making a lot of money back then. And the caliphs at that time were absolutely obsessed with recovering all of this knowledge. So the book, the Goutas book by Dimitri Goutas, is called Arabic Greek Thought, Arabic Culture. Doesn't so much deal with the how as the why. Like, why did they invest their national treasure in what was ostensibly an alien culture? And it kind of makes a mockery of a lot of conflict thesis ideas or a lot of clash of civilization ideas. There was a far more complicated story going on. And again, it wasn't white hats and black hats, good guys and bad guys. It's incredibly complex, and it's got hundreds of different factors going on in it. And the modern mind wants, again, these idiotic, essentialist binary stories where we have, again, and you can flip the polarity of these guys are good and these guys are bad. Well, that's still stupid. You know, just because you flip the poles on a stupid idea, you've gone from one bad idea to another bad idea. So you have to train your mind into not looking at it like that. The other book that I've been reading is about Giordano Bruno, and Neil deGrasse Tyson got into some trouble about him with his first episode of Cosmos when he described Bruno as the martyr who was burnt by the Catholic Church because he believed the Earth moved around the sun. And this was vastly outdated knowledge. So Francis Yates wrote a book in 1960 called Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. And it deals not just with Bruno, but with the Italian Renaissance and how basically the Italian Renaissance was not the recovery of Greek science. It was the recovery of Greek mysticism and Greek magic. And that's when the Hermetic Tradition comes into Europe through translations of Hermetic texts, which were supposed to be from ancient Egypt. And these were regarded as so important that translations of Plato were put on the back burner by Cosimo de' Medici when he found out on his deathbed that these magical books existed in Byzantium. They'd found a copy. He told his translator, Ficino, put the Plato on hold. That's not as important. The books of Hermes, Trismegistus, that's the one that we need first. Give me that. I want to read that before I die. And for about 200 years then, leading on from that, Europe, the Renaissance is a period of the occult, alchemy. I mean, all these things were already there, but they suddenly get like supercharged by this ostensibly ancient book, which is believed to be older than Plato, maybe older than Moses. And it was believed to be that for about a couple of centuries until later studies proved, actually it's from the 3rd century AD. There's no way this thing came from, 2,000 years before that. So, but for that period, people sincerely believed this book was truly ancient. And Giordano Bruno is one of them. And they had all these Hermetic ideas that flooded into Europe. And, you see there's this misconception in the popular imagination that the Italian Renaissance was about science, and that it wasn't, not the way people think. The actual recovery of Greek science happened to the Catholic Church via the Islamic world in the 12th century. And that's been well understood for about 100 years. But again, the popular imagination doesn't get that. People are still being taught this, version of history that's completely garbage. So you start reading it and you start scratching your head and wondering, why were we taught this, like, completely debunked version of history when, from the 1920s, Charles Homer Haskins and Pierre Duhem to begin with, and then modern historians in their lives continue this process of looking into this actual narrative. And, people, it's kind of fascinating. One, the actual history is somewhat more interesting than the ideas we have in our heads. Also, though, it's like, how do these myths just keep going? Why don't they die? What's it going to take to kill them? And why do people who are apparently intelligent, like Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson, continue to peddle fairy tales from the 1870s? What is wrong with them? Do they not know, or do they just want the myth so badly because it upholds their worldview? So I don't know.
So summarizing what I remember from that episode of Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the story goes that Giordano Bruno had a vision maybe given to him by an angel or something, in a powerful dream. But he basically had an intuition that the, God's creation was much, much vaster than this little model with the Earth in the middle and, the planets and the sun circling around the Earth allowed for. And that the Catholic Church insisted that he, renounce these heretical views and embrace the orthodoxy of the Church, and he bravely refused, and under penalty of death, and he was burned at the stake for his heresy. How does the story that you just told about the mania, particularly among powerful people, you mentioned a Medici, for these lost works of mysticism and hermeticism from ancient Greece? How does all that hook up?
Well, let me just address the thing about what Bruno thought. Bruno actually believed these hermetical books from ancient Greece were the true religion. They were the true faith, and that Christianity and Judaism were corruptions of it, and that they were false religions. So he denied the Trinity and the divinity of Christ. That'll get you into trouble real fast. So Nicholas of Cusa was a Catholic churchman in about 150 years before Bruno. And he said that there are many worlds inhabited by other creatures, all made by God. And the Catholic Church punished him by making him a cardinal. So the idea that these ideas automatically would lead you into trouble is clearly not true. And there's a famous historian, Edward Grant, and he wrote a book called Science and Religion. And this is quite some time ago. And it was actually like theologians argued all kinds of mad ideas. I mean, people would be shocked if they knew the kind of freewheeling debates that went on in the Catholic universities in Europe. They were much more freewheeling and chaotic than people might be comfortable with today. And one of the ideas was the multiplicity of worlds. And if you argue back then that God had only made one world or could only make one world, you get into trouble because that would be implying God would not be omnipotent. God is omnipotent. Therefore, God can make as many worlds as God pleases. And the multiplicity of worlds was dogma. You had to accept the fact that, you know, God could, not that he had or would or ever will, but if he wanted to, he could make an infinity of worlds. And so that's totally contrary to the, you know, these stories about Bruno being killed purely on scientific basis. He wrote about 15 books, and 14 of them were about magic and the occult or the Hermetic tradition. And so the idea back then, leading out of the medieval into the Renaissance, we use the terms like the fuzzy boundaries, you know, very fuzzy boundary there, was that older was better. During the medieval period, people had improved upon, and in the Islamic world too, there was this like tension as well. People were improving upon the ancient Greek texts and going far beyond anything that was in the original Greek books. But during the Renaissance, the idea takes off, the older is better, that we had fallen from this golden age and that we had to get back to the source. So if anything was older than Plato or older than that even, then that was purer than anything that was newer. The newer was a corruption of the pure and the old, this kind of Hesiod kind of idea of the golden age. And so the Hermetic books of Hermes, they fit into that. Their original claim was, you know, these books were, and according to comments about Hermes in the writings of Augustine, the church father, it was believed then, Augustine says this book was like as old as Moses. So when this book came into Europe, people did sincerely believe this book is ancient. So it supersedes Aristotle, it supersedes Plato and Pythagoras. So they fell for it. And like I said, this enormous effect, Francis Yates said, the effects on that would be felt on Europe through this mistake of chronology would be enormous. And it's a bit like it's a bit like the mistake of Columbus, thinking that the Earth was like half the size, you know. These mistakes that people made in good faith led to enormous historical consequences. So getting back to my other theme about, you know, people who believe things that just aren't true can have very, very significant effects on the world.
You know, when I lived in in Brooklyn, I lived right across the street from Greenwood Cemetery, which is a very large, very old cemetery where a lot of famous, wealthy people are buried. And if you walk through Greenwood Cemetery, you'll see an amazing number of Egyptian-style stelae, you know, as grave markers. And some of the bigger, fancier mausoleums look like pyramids, and they have sphinxes parked out front. So in not so long ago, the wealthy in this country and in Europe were absolutely obsessed with mystical imagery, much of it from Europe and much of it from Egypt, which I think links up with what you're talking about. What can you say about the mindset of a mysticism-obsessed aristocracy and what legacy that might have even today?
Yeah, it's something that I've been reading about, not as deeply as I'd like, but I've been doing a lot of research into, you know, for my book about the history of philosophy and the various worldviews. And my girlfriend and I just got back from a trip to Dublin, and there was a W.B. Yeats exhibit in the National Library. And they had, it was really nice because a lot of people gloss over Yeats's obsessions with the occult and magic. And they had a lot of the regalia that the occult groups in Dublin and London were using. And they were like the Order of the Golden Dawn. And there was a whole like resurgence of the occult in Europe, beginning with, I think, Eliphas Levi, if I'm saying his name right, in France. And again, laying claim to ancient Egyptian pedigree. I mean, again, trying to make this like ancient claim that our knowledge is really, really old. and that it's not just from the 3rd century AD, you know. And but anyway, so this takes off throughout Europe, mid-19th century on. It really becomes very popular. I know John Michael Greer, the arch druid, claims a lot of these groups were basically glorified sex clubs, that they, it was a way to have adulterous affairs without being publicly disgraced, because nobody would admit to being in an occult order. So you had some kind of like mutually assured destruction going on. You've got anyway, but the 8th exhibit, they had tatwa cards, which are little cards with like symbols on them that you had to meditate on, and they had a little magical box that he built with like different occult symbols on it. So they lay great stress on the magical practice of his life, and his wife did automatic writing, and he would try to translate it into back into English. And at one point, Yeats sent a message to the spirits, saying that if they want, he would spend the rest of his life just working on the automatic writing and abandon his poetry. And apparently then the message came back, don't do that, you know, keep writing poetry. So maybe that was his wife, you know, sending like a direct message, for God's sake, please don't abandon the one limited stream of income, because we can't make money out of automatic writing interpretations. But it was fairly widespread. And, you know, the biography of Aleister Crowley as well is fascinating. You get the sense from a lot of it. If these guys had just been a little more grounded, they could have actually started the bona fide religion. And but a lot of the egos were a little bit flaky. It's clearly like a lot of the people at the time were into Rosicrucianism. And there was a pyramid near my hometown in Ireland, just north of Arklow. It's my hometown. And you can see the pyramid. It's a grave. And you can see it from the town on a clear day. And I know I was out there once, but if I ever go back, I'm going to check it for symbolism, because now I would know what to look for. If it has any like Egyptian or Thoth-like, carvings on it. There was also just the fashion for Egyptian paraphernalia. But I think in the case of these guys' gravestones, I think, yeah, these people are probably Rosicrucians or some Golden Dawn types, definitely.
Have you ever driven on Interstate 40 through Memphis, Tennessee?
No.
Well, you know, Memphis is an Egyptian city. So
yes.
Obviously the city in Tennessee is named after a city in Egypt. And there is an enormous, I mean, enormous black steel and glass pyramid right next to the interstate.
Oh, wow. That sounds quite sinister. Yeah.
Hey, have you heard Douglas Rushkoff's new TED Talk?
No.
This is going to be a bit of an extravagance because it's almost 13 minutes long, but I'd like to play it right now and then have you comment on it.
Okay.
All right, so I'm starting it now.
I got invited to an exclusive resort to deliver a talk about the digital future to what I assume would be a couple of hundred tech executives. And I was there in the green room waiting to go on, and instead of bringing me to the stage, they brought 5 men into the green room who sat around this little table with me. They were tech billionaires. And they started peppering me with these really binary questions, like Bitcoin or Ethereum? Virtual reality or augmented reality? I don't know if they were taking bets or what. And as they got more comfortable with me, they edged towards their real question of concern. Alaska or New Zealand? That's right. These tech billionaires were asking a media theorist for advice on where to put their doomsday bunkers. We spent the rest of the hour on the single question, how do I maintain control of my security staff after the event? By the event, they mean the thermonuclear war or climate catastrophe or social unrest that ends the world as we know it, and more importantly, makes their money obsolete. And I couldn't help but think these are the wealthiest, most powerful men in the world, yet they see themselves as utterly powerless to influence the future. The best they can do is hang on for the inevitable catastrophe and then use their technology and money to get away from the rest of us. And these are the winners of the digital economy. The digital renaissance was about the unbridled potential of the collective human imagination. It spanned everything from chaos math and quantum physics to fantasy role-playing and the Gaia hypothesis. Right? We believed that human beings connected could create any future we could imagine. And then came the dot-com boom. And the digital future became stock futures. And we used all that energy of the digital age to pump steroids into the already dying NASDAQ stock exchange. The tech magazines told us a tsunami was coming, and only the investors who hired the best scenario planners and futurists would be able to survive the wave. And so the future changed from this thing we create together in the present to something we bet on in some kind of a zero-sum, winner-takes-all competition. And when things get that competitive about the future, humans are no longer valued for our creativity. No, now we're just valued for our data, because they can use the data to make predictions. Creativity, if anything, that creates noise. That makes it harder to predict. So we ended up with a digital landscape that really repressed creativity, repressed novelty, it repressed what makes us most human. We ended up with social media. Does social media really connect people in new, interesting ways? No, social media is about using our data to predict our future behavior, or when necessary, to influence our future behavior so that we act more in accordance with our statistical profiles. The digital economy, does it like people? No. If you have a business plan, what are you supposed to do? Get rid of all the people. Human beings, they want healthcare, they want money, they want meaning. You can't scale with people. Even our digital apps, they don't help us form any rapport or solidarity. I mean, where's the button on the ride-hailing app for the drivers to talk to one another about their working conditions or to unionize? Even our video conferencing tools, they don't allow us to establish real rapport. However good the resolution of the video, you still can't see if somebody's irises are opening to really take you in. All of the things that we've done to establish rapport that we've developed over hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, they don't work. You can't see if someone's breath is syncing up with yours. You know, so the mirror neurons never fire. The oxytocin never goes through your body. You never have that experience of bonding with the other human being. And instead, you're left like, well, they agreed with me, but did they really? Did they really get me? And we don't blame the technology for that lack of fidelity. We blame the other person. Now, even the technologies and the digital initiatives that we have to promote humans are intensely anti-human at the core. You know, think about the blockchain. The blockchain is here to help us have a great humanized economy? No. The blockchain does not engender trust between users. The blockchain simply substitutes for trust in a new, even less transparent way. Or the code movement. I mean, education is great. We love education, and it's a wonderful idea that we want kids to be able to get jobs in the digital future, so we'll teach them code now. But since when is education about getting jobs? Education wasn't about getting jobs. Education was compensation for a job well done. The idea of public education was for coal miners who would work in the coal mines all day. Then they'd come home and they should have the dignity to be able to read a novel and understand it, or the intelligence to be able to participate in democracy. When we make it an extension of the job, what are we really doing? We're just letting corporations really externalize the cost of training their workers. No, and the worst of all, really, is the humane technology movement. I mean, I love these guys, the former guys who used to take the algorithms from Las Vegas slot machines and put them in our social media feeds so that we get addicted. Now they've seen the error of their ways, and they want to make technology more humane. But when I hear the expression humane technology, I think about cage-free chickens or something. We're going to be as humane as possible to them until we take them to the slaughter. You know, so now they're going to let these technologies be as humane as possible as long as they extract enough data and extract enough money from us to please their shareholders. Now, meanwhile, the shareholders, for their part, they're just thinking, I need to earn enough money now so I can insulate myself from the world that I'm creating by earning money in this way. You know, no matter how many VR goggles they slap on their faces and whatever fantasy world they go into, they can't externalize the slavery and pollution that was caused through the manufacture of the very device. It reminds me of Thomas Jefferson's dumbwaiter. You know, we like to think that he made the dumbwaiter in order to spare his slaves all that labor of carrying the food up to the dining room for the people to eat. That's not what it was for. It wasn't for the slaves. It was for Thomas Jefferson and his dinner guests, so they didn't have to see the slave bringing the food up. The food just arrived magically, like it was coming out of a Star Trek replicator. It's part of an ethos that says human beings are the problem and technology is the solution. We can't think that way anymore. We have to stop using technology to optimize human beings for the market. And start optimizing technology for the human future. But that's a really hard argument to make these days because humans are not popular beings. I talked about this in front of an environmentalist just the other day, and she said, "Why are you defending humans? Humans destroyed the planet. They deserve to go extinct." Even our popular media hates humans. I mean, watch television. All the sci-fi shows are about how robots are better than nicer than people. Even zombie shows. What is every zombie show about? Some person looking at the horizon at some zombie going by, and they zoom in on the person, and you see the person's face, and you know what they're thinking. What's really the difference between that zombie and me? He walks, I walk. He eats, I eat. He kills, I kill. But he's a zombie. At least you're aware of it. If we are actually having trouble distinguishing ourselves from zombies, we have a pretty big problem going on. And don't even get me started on the transhumanists. I was on a panel with a transhumanist, and he's going on about the singularity. Oh, the day's going to come really soon when computers are smarter than people. And the only option for people at that point is to pass the evolutionary torch to our successor and fade into the background. Maybe at best upload your consciousness to a silicon chip and accept your extinction. And I said, no. Human beings are special. We can embrace ambiguity. We understand paradox. We're conscious. We're weird. We're quirky. There should be a place for humans in the digital future. And he said, oh, Rushkoff, you're just saying that because you're a human. As if it's hubris. But okay, I'm on team human. Now, that was the original insight of the digital age. That being human is a team sport. Evolution's a collaborative act. Even the trees in the forest, they're not all in competition with each other. They're connected with a vast network of roots and mushrooms that let them communicate with one another and pass nutrients back and forth. If human beings are the most evolved species, it's because we have the most evolved ways of collaborating and communicating. We have language. We have technology. It's funny, I used to be the guy who talked about the digital future for people who hadn't yet experienced anything digital. And now I feel like I'm the last guy who remembers what life was like before digital technology. It's not a matter of rejecting the digital or rejecting the technological. It's a matter of retrieving the values that we're in danger of leaving behind and then embedding them in the digital infrastructure for the future. And that's not rocket science. That's as simple as making a social network that instead of teaching us to see people as adversaries, it teaches us to see our adversaries as people. It means creating an economy that doesn't favor a platform monopoly that wants to extract all the value out of people and places, but one that promotes the circulation of value through a community and allows us to establish platform cooperatives that distribute ownership as wide as possible. It means building platforms that don't repress our creativity and novelty in the name of prediction, but actually promote creativity and novelty so that we can come up with some of the solutions to actually get ourselves out of the mess that we're in. Now, instead of trying to earn enough money to insulate ourselves from the world we're creating, why don't we spend that time and energy making the world a place that we don't feel the need to escape from? I mean, there is no escape. There's only one thing going on here. Please don't leave. Join us. We may not be perfect, but whatever happens, at least you won't be alone. Join Team Human. find the others. Together, let's make the future that we always wanted. Oh, and those tech billionaires who wanted to know how to maintain control of their security force after the apocalypse, you know what I told them? Start treating those people with love and respect right now. Maybe you won't have an apocalypse to worry about. Thank you.
These days, and it's a good one. What came up for you listening to that?
Yeah, just a few ideas. The idea of technology and what to do with it, Neil Postman is a great source of books on that because he wrote about Technopoly, I think was one. And this is back in the 90s. I think he died about 13, 14 years ago. But I think it sums him down to you use technology or be used by it. And you don't want to be used by it. And you get the sense when you're on Facebook now that you're being used by it, that your ability to use that platform, you know, you can still use it, but it's controlling you more than you are controlling it. And I recently watched a video, and I forget the man's name, the Israeli academic, and he was talking about social media. And he said if you were to bring a drug to market that produced the same suicide rates as Facebook, it would be banned immediately. And he said that the platforms, these social media platforms, are specifically designed to addict people. And that if you want to addict people, you need to feed on dark energy to do that. So what's going to addict people to social media are aggravation, anger, outrage. And that's precisely what you see. And I'm on LinkedIn. I was for a while there enjoying my LinkedIn feed because LinkedIn made their own social media page now. So when you go to LinkedIn now, it looks more like Facebook, but it tends to be more career based. And this is where it gets personal because I began working was for lynda.com, and then they were bought by LinkedIn, and then LinkedIn was bought by Microsoft. So as a result of this, there's a lot of promoted LinkedIn courses now in the LinkedIn social media feed. And a lot of people don't like this as though LinkedIn was going to buy Lynda for $1.5 billion and not promote them. You know, I don't know what planet people are on. So LinkedIn promotes our courses, and a lot of the comments following these promoted courses, which are free, you know, it's not as if I get paid if you watch these links. I don't. They are free as part of a free promotion. But a lot of the comments are very hostile. And that same process of anger and rage is now infecting a platform that didn't have it. It didn't have it a while back. And now you're seeing direct personal attacks on authors who have absolutely zero control over it. There was one academic with a PhD after his name who was personally attacking various authors whose courses were popping up in his social media LinkedIn feed. This is a World Health Organization person who doesn't seem to understand how corporations work. And just so you're seeing these like attacks that are really incredible. So I don't even read the comments on there anymore. I'm not even sure if I should use that platform anymore or not. As I don't wish to be exposed to that. His argument about social media, the Israeli fellow, was that they were made for people with non-existent social skills, for other people with non-existent social skills. And then this tool, which was never designed for a mass audience, has now reached a mass audience, and the results are fairly unpleasant. His wider point about, you want to make a world that doesn't require you to live in fear is absolutely accurate, but that would involve a completely different economic system. And these people don't want to change the economic system because they're afraid of losing their billions. It's really shocking. And I think when we met in person a few years ago, I told you the story about a billionaire who was in his 80s and he was still struggling to make more billions. And they asked him, why do you keep doing it? And he said, I'm afraid of being poor. I'm afraid of losing it all. This is a man with like $50 billion and he was still afraid of losing it all. So to get a little Marxist about things, you know, the solution is to create a social system in which nobody has to be afraid. And that's some sort of collectivist system. It's not it cannot be a strict capitalist one, but nobody wants to take that on because it's frightening and it's huge and it's dangerous as well because risks come with that too. So they keep blundering on the way they are. And I'm not optimistic about it.
Well, that was all very well said. Even if, you know, the conclusion is the future is dark.
Probably. I hope it's not. I mean, maybe we'll just keep muddling through forever. But I think something will break. You know, I keep looking at with increased amazement, like the stuff going on in Britain with Brexit. And a day doesn't pass without some new strangeness happening. The most recent one was a former British minister, Priti Patel, lovely name, not the lovely woman, who said that if the Irish don't start learning some manners, they stand to lose so much of their economy that their people will starve. And it was pointed out that the British politician threatening the Irish with starvation, given the history of the potato famine, probably wasn't the nicest thing to hear. And then the Irish EU commissioner, Phil Hogan, who's the EU commissioner for agriculture, said that actually Britain gets 40% of its food from Ireland. So if the British Conservatives want to starve their own people, they're going about it the right way. So this kind of back and forth just would have been inconceivable, like even at the height of the conflict 20, 25, 30 years ago. And it's this like ratcheting down of standards of discourse and the way you can see the mask slipping. You can see, you know, how these people think, and it's not pretty.
There's a book that I've heard about just in the past couple of days, and I'd like to read it. I don't know that I'll actually make the time, but it is called Network Propaganda. And the thesis of the book is, as far as I understand it, a rejection of the idea that the anxiety and the vitriol and the partisanship of our current political landscape is the fault of digital media and social media. That there are other forces, other factors which have given rise to this, you know, this level of hostility, which is so. I mean, you know, for somebody who's 16 or 17 or 22 or something, perhaps the current moment just seems normal. But for me at age 50, it is not normal. I mean, I lived through the Carter years and the Reagan years and the Bush years and the Clinton years and the Bush years again and the Obama years. And it wasn't until really the Obama years, I guess maybe the beginning of the Bush years, W. Bush. But really, it was in the Obama presidency that things seemed to get really just so hostile between the tribes in this nation that there was no real possibility for conversation or, you know, even changing the subject to non-controversial topics. It's like we have to these days. It's like cowardly, you know, to talk about the weather or to talk about something non-controversial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the thing is that when you see these very sudden changes, I think it's always a good idea to like look for a technological reason. When something happens so fast, when you know, you might be seeing like a lag effect, like a generation of people who are raised with a new technology when they became in 15 years ago suddenly come of age, or you know, or some new thing has come in that everyone is now using, be it social media. And I think there was always some hostility there, no question about that. But then suddenly it gets dialed up by one or two orders of magnitude. If you start poking around, suddenly you see, well, when did Facebook appear? When did YouTube appear? When did, you know, Tumblr appear? You know, you see Tumblr appears, and then you see all the trigger warnings beginning to emerge, and you know, a lot of like social ideas begin to emerge from the young people, mostly young people who use that platform. And because the changes are so fast, they for all intents and purposes, they happen overnight. And then, you know, like I said, we're like maybe the last generation of people who properly remember, you know, what it was like before all this happened. So, yeah, but we ourselves are the product of television. Postman's argument about technology. He said you don't get technology added to your society. It changes your society. So I think we mentioned this the last time, too, that you don't get America plus radio. You get Radio America. You don't get America plus TV. You get TV America. And politicians emerge that would not have emerged without television. Ronald Reagan would not have emerged without television. He was a television president. Donald Trump is the Twitter president. Could he have come to power without Twitter? Maybe, but I wouldn't like to bet on it because he took that thing and he just used it like a master. You know, this is a corkscrew that went right into the system and he used it brilliantly. And my fear isn't about Trump. It's like somebody coming down the pipe in 8 years or 12 years or whatever, who'll do something even more toxic than that. But yeah, like the technologies are now basically down to websites and apps. I think like the Obama toxification, I don't know to what extent that's the color of his skin, like, you know, triggering like all the American race war fears and because I saw some really ugly things when he was running for president, and I thought there's plenty of reasons to not like Obama. The color of his skin isn't one of them. You know, like, what is wrong with people? You can't look at things in terms of just politics and economics. Why does it always have to be identity markers? And because it gets you nowhere, left or right. But again, that's one reason why I'm pessimistic, because I see people less and less focused on the stuff that's going to affect them, meaning money. You know, you can have all the civil rights you like, but if you can't have healthcare, a good dentist, a doctor, then what good is all that to you? You know, because you're in pain. And I don't know.
The book that I mentioned, which I haven't read, so I cannot represent the views of the authors at all, but it's called Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics by Hal Roberts, Robert Ferris, and Yochai Benkler. So I can't promise that I'll get the book read, but I will at least, you know, look up some interviews with the authors as they promote the book and get, you know, kind of the bird's eye overview of what they have to say. Because what you've been saying and what I've been reading in recent years, and certainly just my own experience with social media, to me says that social media, particularly the big platforms like Facebook and Twitter, is really toxic. I mean, it's really toxic, and it encourages not only bad behavior in our communications with other people, but also just bad sort of interior behavior, you know, just the way we live in a world of argumentation and, you know, championing ideological positions all day because of social media is just not any way to live, as far as I can tell.
The, and I wish that I could remember the man's name. I've quoted him enough, but his issue...
Is it Yuval Noah Harari?
I don't think so, no. Okay. I think his name began with a Z or a V. That's as much as I can tell you, and it was six letters long. My memory is great for some things and not for others. But he said the problem with these social media platforms is that they're uncurated. And he said, we made a decision to have uncurated media. And he said, we used to have forums that were curated. They had moderators. It's like we've all gone back to Usenet. It's like, remember Usenet before they were... You know, and that was like troll paradise.
I do, anybody but I remember join. It fondly.
Yeah, you know, it was anarchic, but once a troll got going, it couldn't be stopped. You know, there was no one to stop them, and there were other terrible things that went on. But and now we've gone to a thing with Facebook where and Twitter where it's pretty much uncurated. It's just like, you know, the idea that this will somehow organize itself into social discourse has clearly been falsified. It's not going to happen. And he said, you can have enormous forums, very productive and very dynamic, that are curated, where moderators will come in and just shut down the toxicity when it reaches a threat, whatever threshold the forum decides is unacceptable. And I think that was a very good point. You know, it's a choice not between free speech and no speech. There's different kinds, you know, that we can choose from. And it's a conscious choice to have this kind of structure. And I've gotten off Facebook pretty much. I keep it open in a tab for personal messages, and that's about it. And I think more people should. I allow myself to read the feed once a week for 5 minutes, and that's it. If everyone did that, Facebook would survive for about a month, and then they'd be gone.
You know, as I've mentioned, I remember Usenet. I remember the pre-World Wide Web internet, and I also remember the early web. And now I've seen the transformation of it as, you know, Douglas Rushkoff said in his talk that he used to be the person who, you know, tried to evangelize to people who had never had any interaction with digital technology. And now he's the one guy, seemingly, who remembers what life was like before digital technology. And I remember what the internet used to be. And if you're, you know, in your 20s or something, the current internet is just the internet. And it's silly to think that it could be any other way, or, you know, maybe some utopian idealist could say it could be different, but it really was different. It's not a could be, it was. Within living memory, you know, of people at middle age, it was a different place, but not everybody was on it. It was a very select subgroup of the population that was interacting via digital media, and that gave rise to a very different sort of social interaction.
Yeah, it's so easy now. Anybody can get on it. It takes no skill at all. You used to have to type in all kinds of scary details into your modem. Oh, God, I remember that.
It was a sort of sorcery getting online.
Yeah, it was a filter.
Well, Dermot, we are down to the last minute, so I am going to invite you to promote your websites and your work, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
Yeah. Well, my website's angryanimator.com, and it's about to go into like a new phase of being like much more active. And I also, I've been collaborating on bloomsandbarnacles.com. It's my girlfriend's website. It's about James Joyce and Ulysses. And we have a podcast and we talk together about it, and it's very friendly. So it's designed for normal people, ordinary people that are interested in James Joyce and Ireland and maybe want to hear some clever stuff.
What's the website again?
Bloomsandbarnacles.com.
All right. Well, Dermot, thanks so much. Talk to you again.
Great. Thanks, Camo.
If you find the programming on Black Sheep Radio entertaining and informing, consider becoming a member. Every penny goes toward paying the bills.
All right, everybody. That's all for this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. I want to let you know that I am doing daily YouTube videos. They've been running about 10 minutes in length, although I'm going to maybe look to shorten them a bit. These are very, very seat-of-the-pants sort of videos. And in fact, let me give you some feedback that I got from one person on Patreon. Gus wrote, "Your YouTube channel reminds me of the circa 2009 YouTube. That's wholesome and real and random, and I like the idea of supporting that, but I don't end up wanting to actually watch it. Although, now that I think about it, that 2009 YouTube still exists out there today in millions of channels in 2018. They just don't get many views. I find channels like yours when I search for something specific and find a video about it with low views and then happen to click into the channel just out of curiosity. Not sure where I was going with this, just random feedback on your YouTube endeavor from a podcast fan." So anyway, if nothing else, you'll get to see a variety of locations from my life. Sometimes I shoot here in the apartment, sometimes I shoot outdoors, and when I'm outdoors, I tend to shoot in different places. So do check it out, and if you have any trouble finding the videos, I've been posting, not all of them, but some of them, to my Patreon channel, or on my Patreon page, patreon.com/KMO. And for those of you who are still subscribed through CROM.com, those are not for patrons only. Anybody can access them. And that will give you a direct link to my YouTube channel on YouTube. All right. That is all. I will talk to you again quite soon. I have the next episode cooking in my head. I will share it with you in the coming days. Stay well.